Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Thinking Christianly podcast, sponsored by Global Scholars. I'm your host, Jordan Plank. Joining me are Dr. Stan Wallace and Dr. J.P. Moreland.
2024 has been called the ultimate election year by Time magazine because of the incredible number of pivotal elections taking place all over the world. And while I am sure that discussing how to have better and more life-giving conversations is always relevant, I think this is an especially important topic for our current moment. In this episode, we're discussing three common logical fallacies. And Stan, I'd like you to start us off by explaining the red herring fallacy, if you would please.
Yeah, sure. There are a group of fallacies that are all informal fallacies in logic that are the kind of, as you said, errors that come up in conversations with people. So these are the kind of things we hear every day in the news and sometimes in conversations with friends and others. And the red herring fallacy is simply when the conversation gets sidetracked, you're talking about one thing and somebody brings something else up that just sidetracks it into a whole nother conversation and then circles back to say, so there, I've answered your objection, and really it hasn't been answered at all. It's just been sidetracked. And it comes from a herring that's very pungent and would take dogs off the trail when they were tracking something. And so it's a way to get the conversation off the trail to truth and onto something else.
Absolutely. Yeah. You start off talking about one thing. And like Stan said, if you drug the smelly fish, a red herring, across the path where the dogs were chasing, let's just say the fox, it might go down the track and go after the red herring instead of sticking on message and trying to get after the fox. So sometimes this will happen in a political debate where, let's say somebody might be talking about defending the fact that we should have universal health care because there are a lot of people that don't have it. And the other person pushes back and says, well, we can't afford universal health care. And then the person begins to say, well, look, you live in a big fancy house. And you've always been against minorities because the minorities are the people who need this the most. And you have a reputation of saying racist things on the air. And I think that your character is in question here. Now that could be a fallacy we're going to talk about later. But right now, you see, the subject was changed from the point that this gentleman made or lady made about why we can't afford health care. And rather than responding to that, they got off on some other issue about their personality, their wealth, so they don't get impacted by this and things about them and their past statements that they've made in public, which is a completely different subject. And so if the person concludes by saying, well, and so as a result of that, you really can't say anything about the subject. Well, you've won the argument by silencing the person, but you really lost the argument because you committed a fallacy. And that happens on a regular basis. Stan, you may have examples of this as well.
Well, I do. And I think we see this a lot of times when we're talking with others about the faith, and they will sometimes sidetrack the conversation so that we really get off the topic. So, for example, I was recently in a conversation with somebody about the claim Jesus made to be the only way to God, and I was offering evidence to support that claim. And his response was, well, that can't be true. Just this last week, a synagogue opened a homeless shelter in my town, and they're doing so much good to make sure everyone has a place to sleep at night. So Jesus can't be the only way to God. Look at all this good work they're doing. And, you know, I just had to point out that the work they're doing is great, but it's not the issue. The issue we were talking about was whether Jesus is the only way to God.
Well, and I think, Jordan and Stan, that this is a particularly problematic fallacy today because of the short soundbite attention span that people have. They're used to having a conversation wrapped up in very short order. And so by dropping in a red herring, it gets the conversation off track. And people who have a short attention span are unaware that they're getting it off track because they can't track with an argument for a very long time. And so they want to wrap this up and they make a point because they're so exposed to social media and television and things, which I'm not against that, but it has created people with short attention spans. And, and I have found that an anecdote to that is really making part of your reading habits, reading apologetics or Christian philosophy books, because when you do that, very often the author is trying to sustain an argument over four or five pages. So you're forced to try to hang in there and listen to the development of the argument. You're going to get lost. So by reading both theology books that do this, books that develop in some detail a lengthy argument is just such a great training of the mind to stay on task. And, you know, I think this is so important, not only for learning to really follow what's being said and not getting off track with a red herring, but I think it's a way of respecting people.
Sure.
Because if you listen to them and keep listening to them and you respond to what they've said, that's a way of respecting that they said something that they want a response to. But a red herring is, I think, an insult. It's a it's a way of disrespecting someone, because what you're really saying is, I don't care what you're talking about. I want to talk about this. And, you know, that's disrespectful, if you ask me.
When you make a great point in our conversations with people, to be careful, we don't, we're not guilty of this fallacy, right? Because it's not a way to love our neighbor, not a way to treat others like we want to be treated. So, you know, not only do we need to watch out for that in conversations where somebody is floating a red herring fallacy that we should respond to, but to be careful, we don't do that. And I think we do. And it's easy to do that. For instance, we might be discussing whether it's reasonable to believe in God. And they say, well, I'm an atheist. I just don't think any of those arguments hold water. And we might say, yeah, but atheism is responsible for such horrific events in the 20th century that you've just got to believe that God exists. And that's certainly true of atheistic regimes. But regardless, I'm not responding to their statement that they don't see the force of the arguments for God's existence. I'm just sidetracking it onto the evils that have been committed under, say, Marxist regimes that have an atheistic underpinning, which it's a red herring. Diverts the conversation from what they're from the point they're making.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And I think it's so, I certainly do this when I have a logical train that I feel like makes sense in our conversation. And then I am more committed to just keeping on, keeping along, no matter what that person might say. So in a way, if I just, if I am not actively engaging in the conversation, I can end up in a place that's completely irrelevant to the conversation I was having. And that can be a bit of a red herring too. It's like, well, I thought we were going to have this conversation, so I'm going to stay with this conversation no matter what you bring up, even if it's a valid argument.
Yeah, that's right. And I think by way of application to parenting, I think it's real important to raise your kids to listen attentively if they're having an argument with their sibling. That your first job is to hear your sibling's charge against you instead of sitting there trying to think of all the rebuttals that you have to them, where you're really not listening. And because I think the red herring fallacy is, it's sometimes intentional, but it can also be the result of just an inability to follow something. And you jump to some other thing, and you're not careful enough as a thinker, and you haven't practiced listening enough to where you don't even know you're doing this. But we need to teach kids that you need to listen and understand what another person is saying, even though you're getting angry and you don't agree with it or whatever. But that's the first thing you need to do, and then you respond to. You need to respond to it. Mm-hmm. And that's just good, I think, parental practice.
Mm. Yeah.
That's good. A great application there. And I also, something that is kind of implicit in this conversation as we're talking about, especially as it relates to our shortened attention spans, we need to understand that some of these conversations are so large that they will take several sessions to work through. And acknowledging that and saying, okay, we're going to cover maybe this ground tonight and this ground next time, or kind of putting lines up so you know where to stop. But it also implies that the person would want to come back and have that conversation with you again. So there's going to have to be a hospitality there where they can have a conversation over a long period of time, because sometimes having those conversations with someone means that you would rather not do that for several more months and would like to avoid it for the foreseeable future. And that doesn't help either.
Right.
Stan, I have a question for you. You've traveled the world so many times and been in so many different countries and cultures, and you may have not paid any attention to this, but if you have you noticed that there are cultures that are less likely to commit a red herring fallacy, and those that you've found that are kind of more likely to do so?
Absolutely. Yeah, and as far as a culture or a political regime wants to impose a certain view without any voice of the people, whether it's a communist country like Russia or an Islamic state like Saudi Arabia, then if opposition to the certain view being promoted is raised, it might just be shut down by force, but it is shut down by a red herring to argue that that's an affront to Mother Russia, or that is an affront to the Islamic religion, when it's actually not. That just gets it off track so that becomes the issue and not the concern being raised.
Good. That's a good point. Very good point.
I've noticed a bit too in honor-based cultures or cultures that have more of a hierarchy. There's just a tendency to pause for longer before someone responds and consider what they're about to say. And I think that brief pause allows the person to order their thoughts in such a way as to be less likely to commit a logical fallacy.
Very interesting.
That, along with being aware of what the logical fallacies are. So I think a lot of the problem is we just don't teach logic anymore in the curriculum. And I'm not talking about formal logic, which is pretty technical and precise and pretty difficult. I just mean what we're talking about here, informal fallacies. They're just so, I think, easy to get your head around once you read a little bit on them and see a few examples, because they're all around us. But we just don't talk about that. It's not in the curriculum. And as a result, I think a lot of the problem is people just don't know what they are and therefore can't spot them and can't be careful not to step into them.
There's a great line in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe where the professor is talking to the children and he's asking them about who's more likely to be a liar, Lucy or Edmund. They said, well, Edmund, every time. And he's asking them, then why don't you believe Lucy? And they're like, well, what she's saying doesn't make sense. And he puts his head in his hands and he says, logic, don't they teach logic in schools these days? So apparently it's been a problem for a while.
That's funny. That's good. That's very good.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the genetic fallacy. Stan, would you explain that one for us?
It's JP's turn. I don't want to start every one of these conversations. Your turn.
Yeah. Well, the genetic fallacy is just a little bit tricky. But let me just start by making clear what it is. It is the fallacy of faulting the evidence for or the truth of some position by citing where it came from. So, for example, you might, you know, be witnessing to somebody and they would say, well, I mean, of course, but I can't trust you because you were raised by a Christian family. Well, yeah, maybe, but that doesn't mean that my view is false, and it doesn't mean that the arguments I'm giving for it aren't good ones. Where I got my Christianity is a different issue than what are the reasons for believing it's true. My elementary school teacher was Mrs. Fred, and she taught us the multiplication table. So, well, look, your understanding of the multiplication tables are completely messed up because Mrs. Fred was really, you know, she was kind of a lowlife, to be honest with you. She hung around bars and she was a little bit loose. And, you know, she didn't have a real good reputation around town. So if you got the multiplication tables from Mrs. Fred, I don't trust your claims about multiplication. Chemistry came from the practice of boiling toads in urine. That was alchemy. And you can't say, well, I can't believe chemical equations because look where chemistry came from. And the same thing is true about Christian claims. It is a genetic fallacy to say that because you got this from the Bible, it's not true or reasonable. And so you have to separate where you got an idea from why you believe it or what are the reasons for it. If I may just one other thing, people will say that God is just a projection onto the world because you need a powerful father figure to protect you from lightning and from harm in life. And so that's why you're a theist. Well, the why is getting confused there. One why is, what does this do for you that would cause you to project their God out in the world? But the why I'm talking about is, what are the reasons for believing there is such a being? And those are very different whys. The first is a motive why. Well, what's your motive for believing in God? And that's skewing you to project God. The other is a rational why. What are the reasons for thinking this to be true?
Yeah, and that's the core, confusing the motive with the reason. You know, it's that, well, you just believe in God because you need a crutch, like you said. Well, whether that's my motive or not, that's irrelevant to whether it's true. It could be my motive and it's still true.
Yes.
And the question is whether it's true, and that's not found by motives, that's found by reasons.
Yep, absolutely. I mentioned that this is a little bit tricky because there are occasions where you can discredit a person's claim, a claim by citing where it came from. Now, this happens in cases where a person might testify to something he or she saw, but we discover that the person has a conflict of interest. And so even though the testimony came from so-and-so, you could fault the testimony because she is not, for certain reasons, a reliable source of information. In a courtroom, this will often happen if they discover that the person on the witness stand has some kind of a vested interest in this turning out a certain way. And so where it is appropriate to discredit some claim because of where it came from has to do with the source being relevant to the rationality of the claim and in a negative way. And when that happens, you're not really committing the genetic fallacy, which means you're just discrediting it because where it came from, but you're actually discrediting the person as a good or whatever the source is, as a reliable, trustworthy source of objective reasons and truth claims. A long, long time ago, I led some kids to Christ when I was at the University of Vermont. And this one young lady was a brand new believer. And I ran into her walking across campus and she was crying. And I said to her, what's going on? Is there trouble? Are you having some hard time? She said, no. Oh, she said, I'm in a human sexuality class. And we got to talking about abortion, and I raised my hand and said, I don't believe abortion is right. And the professor said, well, wait a minute, are you a Christian? And I said, yes. She, well, then your testimony is irrelevant because this, you just learned this. This is a religious idea that you learned. And that was a classic example of the genetic fallacy because it's faulted her position, and she was going to give a reason for it if she'd had time because of where she got this and the motives, therefore, that she was expressing that were not rationally relevant to the claim. So people do this all the time. Mm-hmm. I was spoke at a campus and we were talking a little bit about gender. And this person said, well, you can't speak about this because you're a white male. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? She said, well, white males can't be trusted because they're all about getting the power over women. And she said, that's how I feel about it. And I said, well, have you ever thought about getting therapy so you can overcome this feeling? Yeah. Because I was trying to say in a little bit of a sarcastic way, is that it doesn't make any difference whether I'm a male or white male or not. You got to deal with what I'm saying at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
In fact, this happens in marital conflict all the time. And it's frustrating because my wife will say, well, you know, you were pretty snarky when you said that to me. And I sometimes will say, well, I'm sorry about that. That's another issue. But at the end of the day, even if I was snarky or not, and we kind of get over this and reconnect, you still got the thing I'm saying to deal with because it's true or false whether I was snarky when I said it or was really kind when I said it. Now, that's not a real good way to win a discussion.
How's that work out for you usually?
Yeah, right. Not very well. But, I mean, it's really true. And I think spouses need to deal with these kinds of things on two levels. And the first is, I don't like the way that you're talking to me. And that should be dealt with, admittedly. Mm-hmm. That's an issue. But once that has been appropriately confessed and so on, I'm sorry, but there's still this thing that I said, and I would like to be able to talk about what you think of that, you know, mm-hmm. maybe the next day or something when everybody's kind of calmed down.
Yeah, listeners are just realizing how hard it is for spouses of philosophers, right?
Oh, gosh.
It's like the logician's wife who asked him to go to the store and get a gallon of milk, and if they have eggs, get a dozen. So he brought back 12 gallons of milk as it logically followed.
That's a good one.
I have a lot of compassion for your wives at this exact moment. I just, yep.
Not unlike the woman who gave birth and the husband is looking at the child and the woman, the new mother says, well, is it a boy or a girl? And he says, yes.
Because it is either a boy or a girl.
It is either a boy or a girl. Didn't go well for him either.
Yeah, there you go. There's a time to set aside logic.
Exactly.
It's just funny. And exactly. People wonder why men have shorter lifespans than women. It's just amazing.
Oh, there you go.
You know, it's true.
We will return to the show in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor. Do you have a child, relative, or friend preparing for or attending college? What they need most are Christian professors who can help them learn to love God with their hearts and minds during these impressionable years. Global Scholars equips Christian professors to be there for them and walk with them during their years in college. Please visit www.global-scholars.org to learn how you can help equip Christian professors to show Christ's love on a campus near you and around the world. Please also check out Stan's other podcast, College Faith. While this podcast is focused on the ideas prevalent in our culture, including our universities, the College Faith podcast is more focused on the practical issues of thriving in college as a Christian. Students, as well as parents of students and soon-to-be students, will enjoy hearing from the guests Stan has on the show. Visit collegefaith.net or download episodes on your favorite podcast platform. And now, back to Thinking Christianly.
I think one of the places where I see this genetic fallacy, and it's a really painful place, and I think it has to be dealt with carefully, is when a faith leader falls from grace for whatever reason, and news comes out that they were living this double life, or you can just plug in just about any example, and people will say, well, I lost my faith because that person meant a lot to me. That person was really important to me. And to imagine that they weren't a good person, just, it makes me question everything. And there's a really good reason why they should question the things that that person said. Sometimes it directly relates, but sometimes it doesn't.
Mm.
That gets to be really challenging when you're trying to evaluate whether or not that's a genetic fallacy or not.
Well, this is the best point that I think has been made since we started it, because it's so important. Ravi Zacharias had an unbelievable ministry for decades, and he wrote books and gave talks that were very carefully argued. And in my opinion, he succeeded in showing that Eastern religions are completely unintelligible and there's no reason to think they're true, and that Christianity is vastly superior, rationally speaking. He also used various forms of the moral argument to show that if there is objective morality, the best explanation of that is a personal God. And I think he did a really good job in those lectures. Now, when I found out about this, it literally broke my heart, because I looked up to him. And I think what it did for me is, it, number one, it said, if you become a public figure, you have got to maintain humility on your knees. And while you should be encouraged when people say that was a great talk or I really enjoyed your book, enjoy that for about 60 seconds and then forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it broke my heart because I cared about Robbie, and I needed to look to myself to make sure that I'm not going the same way. But it didn't affect in any sense the benefit that people got over the years from what he taught and what he said. And people shouldn't say, well, that's worthless now, like you pointed out, Jordan, because maybe all along he was, having affairs or whatever it was.
Right. But the argument is the argument. The premises are either true or false, and the conclusion either does or does not follow, regardless of all of that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a note there for us that we should be disentangling the argument from the person, instead of making it quite so personal. That might help us to evaluate a leader better as well.
That's right. That's a great point.
Which leads us into the third fallacy, right? The ad hominem fallacy. So Jordan, I'm going to ask you to summarize that one.
Oh, man. turnabout is fair play, isn't it?
That's right.
So the ad hominem fallacy is, it literally means in Latin, against the man. And in this case, it is mankind. It is attacking the person rather than the position or the argument that a person is advancing. It happens so frequently that we are almost desensitized to it, especially, as I mentioned, during political campaigns and cycles. Those ads are just absolute petri dishes of fallacies. It's just incredible.
And the ad hominem one's really central to those ads.
Mm-hmm.
It's both sides. Let me be very clear that it is the whole gamut here. Right. I don't think anybody escapes unscathed from this fallacy, no matter how much we would like them to. Mm-hmm. I also think it's the one that can be the most damaging to relationships. So, you know, on that big level, you've got politics and these big meta conversations. But especially if you're talking person to person, it's one thing to take a conversation in a direction that nobody wanted it to go, nor does it logically go. It's one thing to discredit the belief based on its origin. It just seems next level almost. It's kind of a tier difference to really attack a person in their character in a conversation. I think it's one of the most damaging things we do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's closely related to another fallacy called the tu quoque fallacy. That's T-U, a new word, Q-U-O-Q-U-E. It just literally means, well, you too. Mm-hmm. You might say to someone, you're always late for appointments. And they might say, well, you were late the other day too. So same to you. Well, that doesn't negate the fact that you have a habit of being late and you need to address it because you're wasting people's time. That's just maybe a silly example. But it's close to the ad hominem because you're coming back and criticizing the person's behavior rather than the objective thing they said about you. Now, I think sometimes when people do the tu quoque fallacy and say, well, look, you know, you forget things once in a while, too. I think what they're saying is that, you know, you're right. I did forget such and such. But who are you to get on a high horse and crush me about that or punish me about it, which we shouldn't be doing anyway, because you have a similar problem. So I think that's really often what's going on when people use this fallacy. And it is very closely related to the ad hominem because it makes the issue back about the person in one way or the other rather than about the claim or what have you.
Yeah. And again, I think Christians are equal opportunity offenders in this. I've heard Christians take a line of argument when criticized for just believing blindly to say the same thing. Well, you're just blindly following the atheistic author or podcaster or blogger you've been reading lately. You know, you're just as unthinking as I am. Whereas, you know, that's not fair. It's not fair of that criticism of most Christians. Most Christians, at least hopefully, have thought about why they believe what they believe. But again, treating others like we'd like to be treated, believing others have their views for reasons they've thought through.
That's good. That's very good. Yeah.
I'll give you an example of the ad hominem fallacy that came up long ago politically. During the civil rights movement, when Martin Luther King was becoming more and more prominent as a spokesman, the FBI began investigating him, and they were trying to determine if he had communist connections or whether he had cheated on his wife. And they wanted to use any data they found to discredit his arguments in favor of civil rights. So it would be, you know, hey, look, this guy is a terrible guy, cheats on his wife, communist sympathizer. So this whole view of civil rights needs to be discounted. And again, it's an attacking him as a person, not the position he was advancing. And so, you know, maybe he did have those ties. I'm not claiming he did, but, you know, let's say they found all kinds of evidence he did and he cheated on his wife and all of that. It doesn't make his case for civil rights any less true.
Beautiful.
So, you know, we see this all the time, but that's a classic example.
Very well put.
And let me give a couple more examples. Mm-hmm. One place it comes up, I think, often in conversations about the gospel is a person will say, well, Christians are all hypocrites. And so that can't be true. And, you know, again, it's attacking the person as a hypocrite, not the truth of the claim they're making that Jesus is God and should be followed. And, you know, it might be true that all Christians are hypocrites. Hopefully not. But it doesn't mean that the truth of the gospel is false. It just means that none of us are following it according to as Jesus taught what it is to walk with him. So, you know, so we see that all the time. We have to be, you know, I think in a loving way, willing to say, yeah, maybe we all are, because none of us live up to the standard he set. But it doesn't mean it's false. It doesn't mean that he's not who he claimed to be and worthy of our following him. Another place we see it is in the public square, in conversations about a number of issues, as we talked about. But I'll pick one that's currently very much in the news, and that's the LGBTQ conversation. And often those who have concerns about whether that view leads to human flourishing are accused of being homophobic. That's another example of this fallacy, because it's attacking the person for an alleged moral deficiency, having a fear or even a hatred of somebody who's other than they are, with whether or not their position, namely human flourishing, comes through a certain way of being in sexual relations and marital relations. You know, those are two different things. The view might be right, even if somebody does have an animosity toward the other. That's the ad hominem fallacy in cultural discourse in the present moment. Mm. JP, would you push back on that, or does that sound about right?
Oh, not at all. I think that happens all the time. And I think it's a great illustration. I've had that happen so many times. And again, well, you're a white male, you know, that sort of thing. And this has been seized upon by cynical and critical theory and postmodern constructivist theory, to where you have an identity group and you claim that the other identity group's views are offensive, they're oppressive, and so on, because it comes from their identity group.
Right.
And that's just a genetic fallacy. It's also ad hominem, both in this case. Right. Happens all the time.
And I think that ostracizing of an entire group of people and saying your voice doesn't matter because these voices haven't mattered before, and so now we're shifting to, you know, elevate these other voices that have been unheard for so long. It's interesting because it implies a zero-sum game where only certain people can talk and only certain people can listen, instead of a marketplace of ideas like we've talked about on this podcast, where, hey, let's compare ideas here. I want to hear all of them because you might have a really great perspective. But what happens when we silence a group of people is that they then don't usually react well to that silencing. There's usually a certain level of animosity that grows. Mm-hmm. I personally think we're seeing this with white males, especially rural white males, in things like the incredible rise in neo-Nazi interest and behavior. If you would have told people maybe 75 years ago that this would be happening, they just would be completely shocked. It's such a strange thing. But when you look at it in context, it makes sense. It actually makes a lot of sense, unfortunately.
Do we have time for me to introduce another fallacy?
Sure, go for it.
I was watching a long time ago a politician, and I'll remove this from the current scene too. But she was on the news, and she was in Washington, and she was making a case for universal health care, and she started off by saying, our Constitution and our Bill of Rights guarantees that we have rights in this country. Even our Declaration of Independence assures us that as American citizens, we have rights. And as a result, we have a right to health care. And if people are trying to go against the government's provision of universal health care, they're actually going against the Constitution of this country. And I find that anti-American. Well, the problem was this. When you read the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the rights that they guarantee, that government guarantees, are negative rights. A negative right is a right to be protected from discrimination or into some other way being manipulated so that I can't get something on my own. So, for example, if healthcare is a negative right, then I have a right, if I can afford insurance, I have a right to get any healthcare I want. And if people start discriminating against me because of my race or whatever, my gender, whatever it might be, the government has an obligation to stop them from keeping me from getting what I can get on my own without being illegally hindered in some way. Now, a positive right is a right for something to be given to you. So if healthcare is a positive right, then the government has the obligation to provide it. Well, there was a fallacy of equivocation, because equivocation is when you use the same word, but it means two very different things. Because in the Constitution, it meant a negative right, but in the healthcare, it meant a positive right. So it was a fallacy of equivocation.
So one of the questions that I had for both of you is that in these conversations, it can be incredibly hard to stay calm and grounded. And I wondered if you had any tips or tricks for defending what you believe about an idea without it becoming a heated debate full of animosity.
Good question. Yeah, I have a thought, and then I have a podcast I'll recommend. The thought is, you know, just the principle of seek first to understand before being understood. So this idea of taking time, not just to respond right away with a counter argument, but step back and I'll often say, now, here's what I hear you saying. Did I get this right? Or could you help me with this? I didn't understand your argument here as well as I'd like to, so that I'm treating them like I want to be treated, that I am seeking first to really make sure I understand what they're saying. So I don't commit a red herring fallacy or some other fallacy where I just get it off track because I really didn't understand what they're saying. So I think that's really important at the outset to take that posture. And I do find that not always, but often if I take that posture, the person I'm talking to is willing to do the same with me. Or if they don't, I say, no, wait a minute, I don't think you understood what I said. They're quicker to say, okay, sorry. Yeah, you're right. You made sure you understood me, so let me make sure I understand you. And it just gives us a different tenor to the conversation. And I'm going to recommend a podcast of a few colleagues of JP's, the Winsome Convictions podcast that Tim Muehlhoff and, help me out, JP?
Rick Langer
do, where they talk just about exactly how to have these kind of conversations in a very hospitable and very productive way. They've thought a lot about this. That's their area of expertise, communication theory, from a Christian perspective. So they do good work on that, and the podcast is really helpful.
Yeah, I like that. And I think just a couple things to add. One thing is to try to view the person when they were a little baby, while you're talking to them, just a precious little thing. And then maybe realize that, you know, I'm looking at a person who's 25 here, and they've had a lot of the hurt, maybe in their family of origin, but they've had a lot of pain and been mistreated and a lot of hurt. And boy, I know what that's like. And I have real empathy for this person, because they started off as this precious little baby, and then they've been battered and bruised by living in this crazy world. And so, man, I'm going to cut them some slack. And so if you kind of change the way you see them a little bit, then it kind of brings out a sense of compassion for them. And you can kind of overlook the horseradish or whatever, you know, it might be. I think another thing that I do is that if a person is being argumentative, and if I am trying to answer their question and they do the whack-a-mole and they just jump over to another question before I've had a chance to answer that one, at some point I discern that they don't want to have a conversation. They want to get me or, you know, nail me in some way. And so what I'll say is, you know, I'm sensing that this is, at least as far as I'm experiencing it, this is not really going anywhere. And I think for me, it's best if I just pull out, and because I don't want to get in an argument. I do want to use arguments, and I'm willing to listen to your arguments, but I don't want to get into some heated argument here. And so if this is a situation where it isn't just on the airplane, you know, you can say, look, I'd be more than happy to get together again, you know, down the road a little bit when we're both ready to kind of hear each other and have a conversation. So that's one thing that I've done, so that I don't just sit in there and pointlessly just let this person vent on me. Now I do want to add something though that's really important to me. I don't think God is nice. Nice is a very tinny word. It's not nice. You know, George Carlin has this little shtick where he compared football and baseball, and it says in baseball you play in a park. Football's on a gridiron. In baseball, you steal home. In football, you ram it across the goal. And so he had this contrast. And one of the things he did on that was to contrast people who were pseudo nice and those that are just straightforward, even if they're gruff. And I think being nice is just not an attribute of God. I can't imagine Aslan being nice. Aslan is merciful. God is merciful. He's kind. He is loving and gracious. No, there's no doubt in my mind about that. But he's also hard. He is straightforward. You look at some of the commands and the way he addressed people. I mean, he could, you know, Agabus, or the name of the person that was helping Paul get his eyesight back. And I can't remember who it is right now, but he's complaining, but God, mm-hmm. don't you know who? And God just cut him off. In the Greek, it just shows he got cut off, and God just cut him off and said, do what I said, you know? Here's what I fear. I fear Christians have bought the view that we're supposed to be nice. And what that means is that we should let people run over us, and we never push back with any kind of force or with any kind of strength. And we're not allowed to use a certain level of sarcasm, which you'll find in the Proverbs where that is used, and you got to be careful about it. But Christians tend to be too milquetoast. And so I don't want them to be overly harsh and cram something down people's throat. But on the other hand, I don't want us to be just a bunch of, you know, milquetoast people. Oh, you know, we got this wonderful little thing to share. Oh, you don't like it? Oh, I'm sorry. You know, no, we have to stand up. I mean, you know, Paul said to one guy, you whitewash sepulcher, you know, and maybe he could do it better than I could. So maybe I better stay away from that. But still, there's a point to be made that Christians need to be bolder and have more courage and be more straightforward and push back in a gracious way, but push back anyway in a conversation. Now, y'all may not agree with that, but that's my view, and I'm sticking with it.
We have a saying at our house that is, you don't have to be nice, but you do have to be kind.
Oh, God, love that.
That's
and
good.
We used it the other day at the playground. One of my kids had gotten shoved over, and I could see the rage just bubbling up. I'm like, you don't have to be nice, but you do have to be kind.
Wow.
And we've teased out what that means and what that looks like.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's a helpful principle.
Yeah. And by the way, it is Ananias who.
Ananias.
Yeah, thanks.
I had to look it up myself. I couldn't.
Not of Ananias and Sapphira.
No, right.
There's more than one.
Ananias.
I have a senior moment.
Yeah, the John of the first century. A lot of Ananias is running around.
Ananias.
But I've also heard it said, and I think it's true, that it depends on the person and their motive. So there are times, and we see this in how Jesus responds to people, but there are times when people are asking, and it could be the same question, but they're asking it with a motive to be harmful, perhaps to others in the conversation or nearby, a very caustic way to put something, which would, I think, the loving thing to do would be to, in a very strong way, push back, disagree, tell them that they're wrong. And again, in a kind way, but not necessarily a nice way, to be very stern, as opposed to a person asking the same question in a very more tender, questioning way, a personal conversation. It might be the exact same words even, but the tone and the motive, very different. Response, very different. So again, I think it comes back to loving our neighbor. Mm. And if someone is being vicious in some way or harmful to others or the kingdom of God, part of our role is to stand up for the person who is being harmed or might be harmed, or for the truth that will not be countenanced if this person is allowed to continue. We see this in, for instance, debates I've seen Bill Craig do, where you wouldn't say he's just a nice milquetoast person at all. He's very direct. He's very clear that he has a view that he's defending and the other person is wrong on this point, but he's kind in how he does that. And I think that's the distinction you're after, and that's good.
Yes. Very good.
Yeah, I think that it is definitely easier to do that. Oh, I guess we just agree to disagree. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's a way to get out of a conversation that's extremely uncomfortable, or that person is not respecting the conversation or the nature of the conversation. And so sometimes that's okay. But I think between good friends and in communities that hopefully we've built to withstand some of these harsh truths, that is a good place to try out, hey, I heard you say this. Is that what you really meant? Or I heard you say this. Is that how you wanted that to come across? Or would you say that again in a different way? Giving people an opportunity again, just like Stan said earlier, treating others as we would like to be treated.
Yeah, I like that, Stan, the way you put that. That's good.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just not that hard, and it is so hard, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
From the principle, it's easy to see what needs to be done. Sometimes it's hard to live it out, but
that's
what we're called to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, gentlemen, anything else before we go?
This was really good.
Yes, it has been. And you might just go online and Google informal fallacies and download what shows up there. Remember, informal fallacies. And you might get a list of them, and you could kind of work on those. They're not hard to understand. And I think they're more practical than a lot of formal logic, to be honest with you. Though there is some formal logic that's just fundamental. But yeah.
Yeah, we'll have some great resources for this episode. There's going to be some fun ones in the show notes, so be sure to check that out.
Oh, great.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, gentlemen.
Good to be with you.
Love you guys.
Love you too, JP. Hope you're well.
Okay, thank you.
That brings us to the end of this edition of the Thinking Christianly podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation in the pursuit of faith seeking understanding. Be sure to check out today's show notes at www.thinkingchristianly.org/podcast, where you can find more information and the resources we discussed. Finally, please do visit our sponsor, Global Scholars. Until next time, this is Jordan Plick, encouraging you to think Christianly.